Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gavir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.
As Press TV documentary has shown, the high rate of violence against women in the U.S. has been recognized as a public health concern, with media in the U.S. contributing to making domestic violence appear unimportant to the public. Experts say given such realities on the ground, the U.S. cannot serve as a role model for women's rights in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records. Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million. In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Braving the bone-chilling weather, mourners are remembering those who gave their lives for the future of this region and beyond.
These people gathered here to pay tribute to martyrs to the war against the key terrorist groups in the region who were backed by the U.S.
General Qasem Soleimani was remembered as a hero for humanity who transcended geographical and ethnic boundaries and whose campaign against the Daesh terrorist groups saved every Muslim and non-Muslim country, including Pakistan.
Mahdi Qasem Soleimani is a way of life and a school of thought to fight the enemies of the Muslim world and the East. If the world of Islam and countries in the East want to save themselves from the malicious designs of the West aimed at breaking this region into pieces to create its new world order, then they have to follow Qasem Soleimani and the strategies he used to save the West Asia region from the collapse.
Speakers at the gathering shed light on different dimensions of martyr Soleimani's life and his legacy, as well as how it impacted the region.
The U.S. and its Western allies had remained helpless and in despair in the face of global terrorism. Martyr Qasem Soleimani put an end to the darkness of this hopelessness vis-a-vis U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorism.
Some 70,000 Pakistani citizens have been killed at the hands of U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorists, including in attacks on schools and children. These were the same terrorists that General Soleimani took out in an anti-terror campaign for which he will always be remembered. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration. And it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, Thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in Thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in Thy kingdom. I beseech Thee to send blessings on Muhammad, Thy servant, Thy messenger. To let me ask Thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for Thy bounties, which alone get Thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey Thee and instinctively worship Thee, and make me deserve Thy rewards on account of Thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of Thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of Thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let Thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The new extreme right-wing Israeli cabinet has started its work with some controversial and provocative moves, although it has assumed power for only about a week. The visit by the hardliner minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier this week drew widespread condemnations from not only the Muslim world, but even the U.S. The same minister has visited Nafa prison today to make sure the conditions of the inmates have not improved and that they don't have, quote, excessive rights, a move that Hamas has slammed as an unprecedented criminal act. The Tel Aviv regime has also issued financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. We'll discuss these issues in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. And also Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off with Mr. Barrett in Madison. The United Nations Security Council has voiced concern about the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound following this provocative visit by the Israeli minister. That's just more platitudes and no action. Why did the Security Council yet again fail to act against another Israeli violation?
Well, the UN Security Council has been running interference for the Zionists for quite some time. Even though the Zionists are the biggest international outlaws and criminals, the violators of the most UN resolutions of any country on earth, they're still given a pass. And probably a lot of the reason for that is that they have so much power in several of the countries that make up the Security Council. So we shouldn't expect the United Nations to solve this problem, certainly not the Security Council as it's currently structured. If it were changed and restructured and became more reflective of the world's population, then that might change. But as it stands right now, this most extreme Israeli government in history, with people like Ben-Gavir, who basically worships Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the Hebron massacre, a serial killer and maniac. And Ben Gavir used to have a big picture of him on his wall that he bowed to, I guess. This guy is a complete, there's really nobody. There's no genocidal maniac on earth today that you could find that could really beat this guy in the sweepstakes for that title. He's now taking up where a long list of other Zionist extremists have left off in terms of provoking violence by attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the oldest and greatest Islamic architectural monument, and trying to set the stage ultimately for demolishing it, as many of these maniacal, ultra-extremist, messianic, millenarian Zionists want to do. So he's taking up where people like Ariel Sharon left off prior to 9/11, when Sharon's job was to set the stage for the post-9/11 crushing of the Palestinians in the run-up to that Israeli demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. So these guys right now in this current government are just completely beyond the pale in terms of anything that even ultra-Zionists like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times can even imagine ever stomaching, and yet the United Nations and the international community are letting them get away with it. And it makes you wonder, what wouldn't they let them get away with?
Ms. Al-Assad, at the United Nations Security Council session, the Palestinian UN envoy said, quote, "What red line must be crossed for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough?" I think it's safe to say that many of those red lines have already been crossed by the Israelis on numerous occasions.
I believe that the United Nations is complicit in the atrocities that have been that are being held against the Palestinians. The United Nations, we have seen how the United Nations act with double standards policy regarding the issue of Iran, for example, the issue of Russia, the issue of China. They all the time condemn these countries while and sanction them, but they don't sanction the usurping occupation entity. So I don't believe that the United Nations will do justice for the Palestinians. The only thing that will do justice for the Palestinians is the righteous right of resistance. This is the only option that the Palestinians must must uphold, because the Zionists there's no a good Zionist and a bad Zionist. All Zionists are occupiers, and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and to get rid of this occupation.
Kevin Barrett, the Israelis, as we've seen, act with impunity, as they are above the law. How has the insufficient international response and lack of action from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, and most notably Arab governments contributed to this status quo?
Well, the international institutions are set up to fail. We don't have real international institutions now. What we have is a kind of a set of institutions, starting with the United Nations, that are fig leaves for the protection of power by the powerful. And for that reason, there was never any real intent to have these institutions enforce any kind of just international law. Instead, they provide cover, again, for, like, the U.S. wanted to wage a war in Korea, so they got the United Nations to approve the Korean War, and right on through the Iraq War, these other kinds of interventions. We always see that the United Nations is not representing a majority of the people of the planet. It's essentially just, again, providing cover for the biggest imperial and state interests. So the real question here is not so much why have the international institutions failed. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. But rather, why haven't any national governments tried to do something about this? And the first national governments that we would expect to stand up for the Palestinians would be the regional governments, the Arab countries. The Palestinians are their fellow Arabs, and of course the Muslim world, and to some extent one would expect the Christian world as well to not particularly appreciate the way the Zionists are committing genocide against Christians in the traditional home of Christianity. But none of those governments, with a very few exceptions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them, have been doing anything to try to stand up for the Palestinians. And they mostly have in the past pretended to be, you know, they give lip service, and every now and then one of them has actually helped out the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein did that in Iraq. Muammar Gaddafi did that in Libya, and then they paid the price. And I think the other leaders in the region sort of got the message that the Zionist-controlled West is going to come in and make your life miserable unless you dance to their tune. And so the people of the region, as we saw in the World Cup, are completely opposed to Zionism and virtually unanimous in their ardent desire for the liberation of Palestine. But most of the leaders in the region are not in line with that because they find it's more in their interests to play ball with the world's biggest powers. And what will make that change, I don't know. Maybe as the Palestinian the Palestinian resistance becomes more popular worldwide, including here in the West, even in the Jewish communities of the West, the younger people tend to be more sympathetic to Palestinians. And as the people in the region put pressure on their governments, maybe that will bring some change.
Mr. Al-Assad, what do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression and provocations, especially the recent storming of Al-Aqsa by the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir? Why now?
Because, unfortunately, the rulers, the so-called Muslim rulers, are complicit in these aggressions that are being taken in Al-Aqsa Mosque, desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing the Palestinians. Four Palestinian children have been killed since the onset of this new year. We saw that the Arab monarchs, the Persian Gulf monarchs, are normalizing ties with the Zionists, shamefully normalizing ties with this occupation, doing nothing to the Palestinians. They said that the so-called Abraham Accords will bring peace and justice for the Palestinians. We haven't seen this justice. The only thing, as I have mentioned earlier, that will bring justice for the Palestinians is the armed resistance. The armed resistance is the key for freeing the Palestinians and supporting them. And as we are marking in these days the martyrdom of Hash Qasem Soleimani, Hash Qasem Soleimani has done what the Palestinians deserve and what do better for the Palestinians, which is supporting the armed resistance and helping those resistance factions. And this what happened in the recent years. We have seen that while the Arab governments and Morocco have moved into normalization, the Palestinian units are getting closer to each other and uniting their efforts against this aggression. And I believe that the more the aggressive the Zionists will be, the more our resistance will unite and will bring this illegitimate entity into its immediate and eventual collapse.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Kevin Barrett, our Ramallah correspondent, has said to us many times that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time, and that any attempt to change the mosque status quo will explode the existing tensions. How important is it for the status quo of Al-Aqsa to remain intact, and what repercussions would there be if that's not the case?
Well, that's right. There's been a kind of a tenuous peace I guess peace isn't maybe quite the right word for it, given the ongoing slow-motion genocide of Palestine, but we haven't seen a kind of third world war along religious lines break out, in part because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which again is the Islamic world's oldest and greatest architectural monument and the spiritual symbol of the universality of the Islamic message, as the symbol of the Miraj of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, who encountered all of the other prophets, including the founding prophets of Christianity and Judaism, as he ascended into the nearness of God. That great symbol and that great monument means, you know, everything to the Muslims. And the Zionists have a kind of a millenarian messianic mythology that spun off into outright Satanism with Shabtai Zvi in 1666. And those Satanists who have spun off from Judaism and Zionism are dedicated to bringing their false Messiah, their Dajjal or Antichrist, to rule the world by destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and building a blood sacrifice temple from which the world will be ruled. This is this bizarre millenarian messianic mythology that the ultra-Zionists, and perhaps including Ben-Gavir and his friends, believe in. So keeping the inviolability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is absolutely paramount in terms of preventing massive global bloodshed if the Zionists do decide to either try to destroy or to take over a portion of this mosque, which Ben-Gavir has announced his intention to do. It's a huge issue, and this is the kind of issue that at least should be talked about honestly in the United Nations, but it hasn't been, and the world's biggest powers have every reason not to want some kind of huge explosion there that could destabilize the world and interfere with their own interests even, have been slow to talk about this and to try to find a solution to it, because the Zionists, again, they have so much power, and for the Zionists that control the Western media, that dominate Western finance, even though most of them are not Ben-Gavirs themselves, are not that fanatically attached to destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and putting up a blood sacrifice temple to usher in the reign of the Antichrist. A few of them probably are, but most of them aren't. But they still have this mentality that Jewish interests can do no wrong. And so they won't let the Western governments do anything about this.
Ms. Al-Assad, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a weekend. To name one instance, there was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to the Nafa prison with the aim of harassing the Palestinian prisoners there. Hamas has, of course, responded to that. It's called this an unprecedented criminal act, adding that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation that our people will not let it go unnoticed. Are the Israelis, with this new far-right cabinet at its helm, in search of escalating tensions, in your opinion?
I believe that this reckless actions, unfortunately, the Zionists don't learn lessons from their previous experiences. We have seen what happened last summer, last May, during Saif al-Aqsa operations. Unfortunately, they don't learn lessons that as long as they insist in desecrating our holy places and killing our people and murdering our people, their option to resistance became more substantial and more and it's the only key to put an end for these aggressions. I believe that the Muslim population across the globe, across especially here in West Asia, must pressure their governments. They must use the alternative media to expose these violations, and to work hard to support the Palestinians, and also the Palestinians must unite, must exert all the possible efforts in order to put an end for these aggressions. I don't believe that the Zionists. I believe that the Zionists take these measures in order to provoke the Palestinians, but the Palestinians will respond, and this is their right to respond and to resist these aggressions.
Kevin Barrett, the office of the new Israeli Prime Minister has just announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in response to their appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime will also impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction as well. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions?
Well, they're trying to punish the Palestinian Authority for, in this case, doing the right thing, going to the International Criminal Court, Court of Justice, and trying to get some justice for some of these crimes that have been committed against them. And, of course, the old saying is no good deed goes unpunished. And so the Zionists are punishing the Palestinian Authority for doing something right. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority has done wrong things as well, and it has made too many accommodations with Zionist power. The Zionists think they own the Palestinian Authority, and to some extent they have. They've had a lot of influence over it in the past, at certain points at least. But now I guess they're trying to rein it in, and they're saying, well, if you give in to popular opinion and press these war crimes charges against us, then we will do what we can to make your life more difficult. So that's the sort of thing the Zionists always do. They're always finding ways to retaliate against anyone that's either done something to them or that they imagine has done something to them. And so this actually, it could be a good thing if the Palestinian leaders realize that it's time to stop dealing with the Zionists. Alan Hart, the former BBC lead correspondent for the for Israel-Palestine, personal friend of Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, used to say in the last years of his life that the Palestinian Authority really should dissolve itself, and that would make the Israeli occupier 100% responsible for everything happening in the occupied territories, and that would put the ball in the next court. And maybe it's time for the Palestinians to do that. But in any case, this will force the PA closer to the views of the majority of their people.
And Ms. Al-Assad, Hamas has pledged to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its actions. The PA has said before that any aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Now, Russia's UN envoy in the recent Security Council session recounted the events that took place back in the year 2000 after Ariel Sharon stormed Al-Aqsa, sparking the second Palestinian intifada. Analysts and observers say we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. How do you see it?
The entire axis of resistance has actually warned against another intifada, because as we have mentioned that the Zionist occupation is manifesting on a daily basis its aggressive hostilities against the Palestinians, against our holy places, murdering Palestinian minors, women, and with full impunity, because the Zionist occupation knows that no one will hold them accountable. And as we see that as I've mentioned, that the Persian Gulf monarchies are turning deaf ears and blind eyes to these aggressions and getting closer to the Zionist enemy. And we see that Ansarullah has warned against the aggressive policies of the Zionist enemy, also Hezbollah in Lebanon. We witness the aggressions on a daily basis that are targeting Syria, also the Judaization of Manama in Bahrain. All of these movements that are taking place by the Zionist enemy will lead eventually, yes, to another intifada, and perhaps it's time that we will witness the collapse of this temporary Zionist occupation in our West Asia region.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, joining us from Madison, and Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we completed explanation of Surah Saf, and from this Friday and the next, we embark on explanation of the next Surah, that is Surah Jum'ah, which is number 62 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. Revealed in Medina, it has 11 ayahs and enjoins the believers to proceed to the ritual congregational prayer on Fridays by quitting all commercial transactions on hearing the azan or the call to prayer. Otherwise, they deserve censure. The surah derives its name from Friday. It opens with the glorification of Allah and the Prophet's call. It says that the Muslims are not supposed to be like the Jews to whom God granted the Torah, but they failed to act upon it. We now invite you to listen to the opening ayah of this surah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يسبح لله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض الملك القدوس العزيز الحكيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, whatever there is in the heavens and whatever there is in the earth glorifies Allah, the Sovereign, the All-Holy, the Almighty and All-Wise. Like the previous one, opens with the glory of the Almighty Creator, whom everything in the universe, whether animate or inanimate, glorifies, since as the Sovereign, the Omnipotent, the All-Wise, and the All-Holy, He is too glorious to have any defects and possesses the most sublime attributes and the most beauteous names. As mentioned earlier in the Noble Quran, in Ayah 44 of Surah Isra, most human beings fail to realize these divine attributes. There is not a thing in the universe but celebrates his praise, but humankind do not understand their glorification. According to the Islamic worldview, the human being, although the best of creation, is not the only being that praises and worships the Almighty Creator, but all creatures worship God at all times in their own peculiar ways that are beyond the understanding of mankind. The Prophet of Islam forbade the beating of animals, since these creatures glorify God. He has said, "There are many amounts better than their riders, since they praise God Almighty more than their riders." This ayah teaches us that, number one, all created things, whether animate or inanimate, worship and glorify the Almighty Creator. Number two, Allah is not just the Creator, but the all-wise administrator of the entire universe, and none can confront His will, decision, and decrees that make the functioning of the world of nature in an orderly way. Now let us listen to the next ayah, that is number two.
هو الذي بعث في الأميين رسولا منهم يتلو عليهم آياته ويزكيهم ويعلمهم الكتاب والحكمة وإن كانوا من قبل لفي ضلال مبين.
It is he who sent to the unlettered people a prophet from among themselves to recite to them his signs, to purify them and to teach them the book and wisdom, while they had indeed been earlier in manifest error. This ayah points to the fact that the all-wise Creator did not leave in the dark without guidance the human race. Allah, who sent a long line of prophets beginning with Adam, the father of mankind, raised among the unlettered Arabs the last and greatest of His messengers, that is Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The prophet to whom God granted the noble Qur'an as the final heavenly scripture recited the divine revelation to invite them to monotheism, piety and wisdom, through purifying them from any kind of polytheism, error, vices and corruption. The prophet's mission through this flawless book of timeless wisdom was to foster unity and educate people in terms of knowledge, ethics, and practice to enable them to strive for moral perfection in order to make them proceed on the path of salvation toward the bliss of paradise. It is indeed a manifest miracle on the part of the Prophet of Islam, whose own God-given immaculate characteristics helped deliver the message of the Noble Quran to deliver people from the darkness of ignorance and vices through instilling in them faith and moral virtues. From this ayah we learn that, number one, the mission of the prophets is to deliver people from the darkness of vices and ignorance through inculcation of faith in God Almighty, virtue and knowledge that leads to perfection of morals. Number two, it is indeed a divine miracle to raise a person amongst an unlettered nation to mold it into a torchbearer of civilization. And number three, self-purification is only possible when there is resolve to abstain from all impurities, such as idol worship, carnal desires, and developing the ability to discern between right and wrong. Let us now listen to ayahs 3 and 4 of the same surah.
وَآخَرِينَ مِنْهُمْ لَمَّا يَلْحَقُوا بِهِمْ وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْحَكِيمُ ذَلِكَ فَضْلُ اللَّهِ يُؤْتِيهِ مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَاللَّهُ ذُو الْفَضْلِ الْعَظِيمُ
And to others, from among them who have not yet joined them, and He is the Almighty, the All-Wise. That is Allah's grace, which He grants to whomever He wishes, and Allah is dispenser of a great grace. These ayahs are a clear reference to the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. His message of Islam was and is not limited to the either of the Arabs or the contemporary nations of his time, but for the entire human race, encompassing generations upon generations to follow until the end times. It is said that once, when asked as to who were referred by this ayah, the Prophet pointed towards Salman Farsi, who was a non-Arab and belonged to the nation of Iran, in the same manner as Bilal was an Abyssinian from Africa, and Suhaib was a Roman who had embraced Islam. The Prophet has also reportedly said about Salman, "If faith happens to be in the pleiades, men of this nation, that is Iranians, will attain it." Since all such things stem from divine might and wisdom, Ayah 3 closes by saying that God, the Almighty, the All-Wise. The next ayah is a reference to Allah's great divine grace, the Prophet's universal mission of Islam, and his elaboration of divine teachings that rescued people from false beliefs and superstitions. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the Prophet's divinely designated vicegerent, elaborating on such divine great grace, says in Sermon number 192 of the famous book Nahjul Balagha, "Now look at the various favors of Allah upon them, that He deputed towards them the Prophet who got them to pledge their obedience to Him and made them unite at His call. Look how Allah's bounty spread the wings of its favors over them and flowed for them streams of its blessing, and the whole community became wrapped in blissful prosperity." These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the mission of the Prophet of Islam is not exclusive to the Arabs or the people of his time, but it is for all humanity, including people of all ethnicities and of every place on planet Earth. And number two, the Prophet, as the mercy unto the creation, guides the seekers of truth towards faith, virtue, justice, and salvation in the transient life of the mortal world and the reward of the bliss of paradise in afterlife. We end this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment with recitation of Ayah 5 of Surah Jum'ah.
مثل الذين حملوا التوراة ثم لم يحملوها كمثل الحمار يحمل أسفارا بئس مثل القوم الذين كذبوا بآيات الله والله لا يهدي القوم الظالمين.
The example of those who were charged with the Torah, then failed to carry it, is that of an ass carrying books. Evil is the example of the people who deny Allah's signs and Allah does not guide the wrongdoing lot. This ayah is a warning to those Muslims who learn the Noble Quran by heart and recite it, but do not follow its guidelines, such as the Israelites who, by violating the laws of Prophet Moses and ignoring the teachings of the Torah, ended up as asses carrying bundles of books without knowing their contents. It is said, when the Jews of Medina mocked at Islam, this ayah was revealed. It means, had you read the Torah carefully and acted upon it, you would not have said such words. Since the Book of Moses bears the glad tidings of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. From this ayah we learn that, number one, the Quran likens to animals, the negligent people and scholars who do not put their knowledge into practice, because they neither benefit from the light of wisdom nor provide benefit to others. Number two, the Noble Quran is not for mere recitation, but a believer should ponder upon its words and put them into practice. And number three, rejection of divine books means disobedience of God's commandments.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.